Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. Here we are, together in the middle of November 2025. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. This is Desert Oracle Radio Replay, and I'm your host, Roxana. Whew, what a week this has been. I hope you got to see the incredible auroral displays. Are you one of those people that actually hears them too? Well, the sunsets have been spectacular. Maybe you are an early riser and saw the sunrises. The winds have been busy this week, yet in some ways, it seems the days are holding their breath. Is this a time of deep introspection for you, like it is for me? I could go on, but we have a show to do. Well, last week, we ended with Joan Ruth Bird beginning to tell us about secrets, and we will continue that interview in the second half of the show today. But let's begin right now with today's Desert Oracle Radio episode from November 11th, 2022, produced by Ken Lane. Here is the Library of Desert Secrets.
Tonight you will hear many mysteries of the desert. Some are cruel and terrible, others sublime, and a persistent few remain inexplicable by our current metrics of understanding. Desert is wilderness stripped bare. And when left alone, it's creation in perfection. The landscape is vast and it is visible. The geology raw and exposed, the plants and animals in ideal proportion. Fresh water is generally in limited supply, but that has never stopped life from thriving in these lands of little rain. Our own species has always been fond of these harsh and arid places. The first civilizations rose up from desert sands, Mesopotamia, and ancient Egypt. The wilderness of antiquity was wild desert, that's what they meant. And that's where our philosophers and our prophets went to meditate on mountaintops, to abandon society for a while and sleep under the stars or within limestone caves to argue with devils and commune with the angels. There were many river valley civilizations in the North American desert too. long before our current mess of outlet malls and cell towers and interstates. The Hohokam and the Salt River Valley, beneath modern Phoenix, the ancient Pueblo culture of the Four Corners. The Taos Pueblo is a rare unbroken link to those very past, despite the plastic letters on the gas stations, on the same banal television program beamed or streamed into every home. Taos is more or less as it was when Hernando de Alvarado arrived uninvited some 5 centuries ago. And as it had been for centuries earlier, when the Roman Church was still struggling to Christianize the diverse peoples of Europe. Through a combination of accident and intent, much of the American desert remains mostly intact today. Mostly wild. The accident was in the claiming of so much American territory by the U.S. federal government in the mid-1800s. Actions taken to prevent competing claims and occupation by Spain, Mexico, France, England, Russia, all of our old imperial rivals. The places with surface water attracted some settlers, despite the heat and the sandstorms and scorpions. While the vast walls of mountains and expanses of dry lakes and scorched valleys were spared too much permanent development, this was followed by dramatic efforts to preserve and protect these desert ecosystems as national parks and monuments, federally designated wilderness. Actions inspired by the nature mystics of American transcendentalism, like John Muir, himself a desert rat. You know, the John Muir Wilderness is surrounded on 3 sides by the Great Basin Desert. He got down there now and then when he wasn't worshiping trees. But he was a disciple of Ralph Waldo Emerson, the Harvard theologian who created a new religion for this vast North American nation, a Gnostic religion. Gnostic meaning knowledge, to know, gnosis. For the good reverend, transcendence required no churchly conduit. The human soul could directly experience the truth and knowledge of the Creator and of creation through direct experience with the latter, nature itself, wild nature. No priest needed. In the 21st century, conservationists aim to protect entire ecosystems, not just photogenic islands of flora and of fauna, surrounded by industrial mining and eroded cattle range. Even without the dense forests we associate with the crucial storage of carbon on this planet, wild desert forms an immense carbon sink. Over a third of our planet's landmass, from the ancient aquifers beneath the parched surface to the vast networks of cryptobiotic crusts that bind the desert together. There's good crypto and bad crypto, is what I mean. throw out the word with the worthless computer currency. Crypto means concealed, secret. Just beneath the desert surface is a complex and hidden world of life, and it holds it all together. The Joshua tree and the juniper, the black brush, the sagebrush, the creosote. This is a brief attempt to answer a complex question. Why is so much of the American desert held in public trust? The answer is not intended to negate the deliberate horrors visited upon indigenous cultures, the wide-scale extermination of desert species, or the determined efforts today by industrial fanatics to reverse our limited protections of this earthly paradise. Because the earthly paradise is real. But it used to be the whole world. That's the immeasurable loss recounted in the universal tales of the Garden of Eden. Of which we were thrown out. Shame and hunger, that's the immeasurable loss described in the universal tales of the great deluge, the great flood, after the last ice age, when the salt water of the Mediterranean rose up over the Bosphorus and flooded the low-lying areas that circled what was then the freshwater Black Sea. Paradise lost. From wandering bands of happy humanity to the toil and misery of the work week of agriculture, of the boss man and the warlord, of the crazed old king. When you are in the great desert wilderness today, you must carry some understanding of why it's like that. Why it's so contrary to the numbing sprawl of our current civilization. It's the way it is because people spent lifetimes fighting to keep it that way, suffering more defeats than victories. Because when you love a place, that is what you do. If this landscape affects you, affects your soul in some manner, you may have no choice but to join the noble and holy effort. We could use the help out there. Whether you become a park ranger, or join the Conservation Corps, or disappear into a cave in the Eastern Sierra, or volunteer a couple of times a year to clean up a nature preserve, or lead school kids on backcountry hiking trips. You might even become an outlaw. You might even become a hero. We are not so far away from the old times, from the times of adventure, of great deeds. So do not fall into the traps of anxiety and hopelessness. There is purpose waiting out there for anyone who comes in honest pursuit of it. A revelation in the desert is available to you in our time. It may fit a practice or a theology that you bring, along with your water, your walking sticks, and your IPA cans, and your yoga mats. Or it may shatter your psyche entirely. Both are worth the effort, worth the trouble, worth going where few others travel, We're leaving behind the dull comforts of tourist resorts and hamburger chains. Some people see the face of God, whoever she is. Some people get blasted by light beams on a desert highway. Some people fall off a boulder and spend days wondering if they'll live or die, and it's always one or the other. I witnessed pure, wild joy on the face of a visitor simply because there was no telephone signal available, no electronic map display to show the nearest cluster of coffee and fast food franchise locations on the honky-tonk highway. Out here beyond the robotic grip of a civilization in disarray and despair, I promise you will feel human again, if only for a little while. Should this experience of old wonder appeal to you, then you will be back as often as possible. And you may have no choice but to call the wilderness home. And if it's home, you have no choice but to defend it. There's nothing more fun than having a purpose in life. Welcome to Desert Oracle Radio Live. Library at the Mark Taper Auditorium. But it's good to see you all. To see your silhouettes, anyway. It's good to come out to the city now and then for a good cause, a good reason. And would you please welcome our musical director, Red, Blue, Black, Silver. He comes all the way from his hidden cave in Joshua Tree. Somewhere. Don't try to find him. Don't wander the night listening for his sounds, because his cave is completely soundproof as per National Park regulations. We are recording this program tonight, and everybody hearing it later will know it's a live recording, so you're welcome to make some racket. Make a little noise when the spirit moves you. Somebody came up to me after the last show, which was in Portland, Oregon, and said, I'm sorry, I was laughing. And I said, you know, I do try to put a little entertainment in the show. I don't mind. It's not a funeral. And you should laugh at funerals, too, you know, if you appreciated the person. Or if they're a comedian, say, a Rodney Dangerfield. Who followed me on Twitter recently, and I thought that was kind of weird. Happy winter storm season to you all. Even Los Angeles looks sort of clean, I noticed. After a couple of blasts like we've just had, and we'll hopefully keep having, remember to do your rain rituals. A lot of people these days only burn a votive candle or whatever for their own personal gain. Like those votive candles when you've got a court date. Have you seen these? Maybe for a criminal charge or a divorce case. Whatever, you buy one of these candles, and they're called Lawyer Gets Sick. You get that at the Botanica, and you burn it the night before. But on the side of it, there's a cartoon of this sort of cartoon lawyer. And he's tripping and falling and briefcase, all the papers are flying everywhere. What's it off? What's off the trouble for a little while? Maybe the judge will say, well, case dismissed. Lawyer got sick. You're free to go. Do some magic for the community too, for the world. We need it. There is nothing like taking a walk, a hike, a ramble, up the mountain, down the wash, along the dirt road, after a winter storm. Everything is clean and beautiful. The birds are chirping happily. The coyotes are joining together in their raintime autumn carols. And all the weird bugs flushed out by the rain are running around the floors of your house or apartment. Just a short little burst of life before it gets really cold up there. Listen, at the tail end of this show that we're doing right here, I'm going to invite a couple of you to share your own weird campfire story. You don't have to use your actual name. You don't have to give your social security number. Just come up and tell a little story about something weird. There's a sympathetic crowd. And when we do these shows, it tends to draw kind of repressed memories out of people, you know? We did a show late last year, I believe. And I could not get anybody to come up and tell a story. This was in Dallas, I think. And I saw somebody get up and kind of walk toward the stage. And I said, hello, welcome, come on up. And she kind of froze. And then she said, I was actually just going to the bathroom. And come on up. And I use this as an example because it's such a great example. She came up, she told the wildest story I'd ever heard. She said, one time when I was about 10 or 11 years old, I shared a bedroom with my younger sister. And I woke up and she was levitating 4 feet over the bed. That was just waiting for somebody who was only trying to slip out. The one thing that has lingered with me with these stories of the cattle mutilations, which are ongoing, especially in light of John Mack's research with the people who had experiences they described as abductions and often became not just environmentally aware but vegetarians in many cases, which he found extremely noteworthy. Is that maybe these events are trying to tell us something about the keeping of cattle, about beef, one of the key elements of the development of our human civilization. The oldest known ceremonial temple on Turkey's grassland with the great column showing scorpions and snakes. The understanding today, which is changing all the time, is that these places serve not as permanent habitations, but as immense outdoor temples. for seasonal beer and barbecue festivals. The houses that were initially thought to be homes, it turns out that they look more like places where you would make beer and ale with great trays for the grain to ferment. People did not seem to live there full time. They came in droves at special times of the year. They harvested wheat. And they slaughtered the large semi-domesticated cattle that they had begun fencing in. And they offered up plenty of both to their gods, who were unknown to us. We can see the scorpions, we can see the serpents, we can see the beautiful reliefs carved into the columns of foxes. Which is when it gets especially weird, but I think it's going to be in a radio show or a book coming up. We ran out of time. And they tell me, I want to thank you all for coming out tonight.
Library
is now closed. All right, one more hour.
Good evening, patrons of the Richard Hayes.
I've never been thrown out of Dick Reardon's library before, but it's a beautiful thing. I want to thank you all for coming out tonight. For braving the city, braving the library, and coming to this beautiful theater. Thanks to Zebulon for putting the show on. Thanks for leaving the PlayStation or the Crown or whatever and coming out. It's fun to come out now and then, in moderation. Leaving the cat behind. Hopefully nobody will do anything while you're doing it. Or hopefully the cat didn't do anything terrible. That's usually the case. Thanks to Red, Blue, Black, Silver for joining me on this last traveling stage show that we're doing. We may do something or other in the future, but this exact thing, this is it. So, when it's ready to be revealed, whatever we do next, I'll let you know. Probably not on Twitter, so keep your ear close to the radio. It's a time of great festivals coming up, our great seasonal festivals on the Wheel of the Year, and I hope you'll take part with family and friends. Our great feast of Thanksgiving. You know, you look back at the old calendars, the medieval calendars, and it was a festival or a feast about every 10 days. And now we have two, I think. So, the weather is crisp, it's beautiful, from the Mojave all the way out to Culver City, probably. So, from Amboy to Zizix and across the Great Mojave Wilderness of the American Southwest, this is Desert Oracle Radio, and I'm your host, Ken Lane. Good night from the voice of the desert.
That reminds me to remind you to work your magic to bring the snow right now. It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio, transmitting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. Joan Bird is the author of the book Montana UFOs and Extraterrestrials. We heard part one of my interview with her last week. Here is part two. Today, and you may have covered this, but just in case we didn't, I wanted to ask you, are UFO and phenomena associated with them still being reported around the world? And what is a reliable source of information about it?
Oh, yeah, they're being reported all over the place. And reliable source is very tricky because we have very advanced spacecraft. That's part of the secret space program. That's part of the secrecy. Mm-hmm. And the secrecy is amazing. Whoever it is, the intelligence agencies, a lot of times, you know, the presidents don't even know about this. Mm-hmm. They don't have a need to know. It's some other groups that are not officially elected that have gotten in control mm-hmm. of keeping the lid on these programs. And I think we are finding out more and more that it's actually the aerospace industry that has been in league with these black ops, secret military groups to back engineer from the UFO crashes. And there's been more and more people coming forward talking about being part of these crash retrieval teams or knowing about the crash retrievals, that this is something that's been going on mm-hmm. for a very long time. Roswell is one of the most famous of those. Mm-hmm. So we have back engineered those. There's a great book called The Day After Roswell, in which Lieutenant Philip Corso, who was in the Army, mm-hmm. talks about how he was recruited to look at the Roswell crash files and materials mm-hmm. and decide what to do with them. And his recommendation was that they provide those to corporations that were doing research in related areas and see if they could back engineer from those materials to get the technologies that those materials indicated these civilizations had. Mm-hmm. So he claims that things like lasers and what else? I guess, what do you call it? Being able to see in the dark, infrared technologies.
Night vision.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Night vision. Mm-hmm. And fiber optics. Mm-hmm. That those were all things that were able to be back engineered from UFO crashes. Mm. So we have craft that are very difficult to distinguish from visiting craft.
Hmm. Is that right? Wow.
And there's still a lot of disinformation being sown out there. The whole thing with all of the drones, mm-hmm. I think they were explained away as being all, you know, objects that the FAA knew about and they were ours and blah, blah. And yet there were a lot of them that just were not explainable and did not fit those descriptions. And those were ignored. Or, you know, once again, the government has taken the stand where, oh, we can explain everything. It's all unexplainable mm-hmm. to try to dampen people's natural interest in mm-hmm. trying to figure out what's going on. They've just gotten to be such experts at manipulating human opinion, partly through, you know, marketing all that Madison Avenue taught us about how to manipulate people's mm-hmm. thinking and feeling. Mm-hmm. And then on the intelligence agencies have just taken it to another level.
Yeah.
Where there was a fellow that spoke at the last UFO conference I was at, who was a part of intelligence for a while. I think it was Army intelligence. I don't think it was the CIA. And he said that PSYOPs, psychological, short for psychological operations,
mm-hmm.
are very widespread, which is like a manipulation of the media to get people to think in certain ways. And the first big PSYOP was about UFOs, to convince everybody that, you know, everything can be explained, it's not a real phenomenon. And anybody that thinks that they've seen anything, then, well, you know, you have to be kind of wondering about their mental health, or are they just trying to get attention, or do they really know enough to be able to report, sowing seeds of doubt. And that has done such an amazing job of convincing people they're not real, mm-hmm. that they're, in spite of all of the evidence that is emerging right now in Congress, there are still a lot of people who just can't go there.
Mm-hmm.
It's curious, mm-hmm. curious how entrenched we can become in our beliefs. And I think that that has to do with how, just how skillful these intelligence agencies have become at manipulating the mass consciousness beliefs.
Do you think the military ever, masquerades an event to draw attention there away from something they don't want us to see?
Oh, yeah. I think, let's see, distraction. They come up, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Little distractions. When there's something that kind of pops up that's totally out of the blue, it's always good to look around and say, okay, might there be something that they're trying to distract us from?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. And can you give any advice to someone that would like to pursue UFO and extraterrestrial studies, like a course of study or any volunteer work or other ways to learn?
Well, oh my golly, there's just so much out there right now. There's a number of universities that are offering official classwork. You can actually get degrees now in ufology,
mm-hmm.
from Ubiquity University is one of them. There's another one in San Diego that has an unusual name, and the man who started it, he has a hyphenated Scandinavian last name that I can never remember, but his first name is Sean, and he's quite knowledgeable, and I imagine it's quite a good course. I'm sorry, I can't recall the name of it right off the bat, but Michael Sala, who has been a researcher and has written gobs of books, he is an academician himself. He studied international peace studies and was a professor in Australia before he came to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
as a visiting scholar for a year at American University, and then published his books, Exopolitics, which talks a lot about the funding for UFO research, which is hidden in black ops.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended his whatever his contract was with American University, and ended his marriage, and he went off to Ohio or to Hawaii, mm-hmm. and found and ended up with a lovely woman who swims with the dolphins and was in Hawaii and did a lot of work there. So he's one of the UFO researchers. He's a very good researcher,
mm-hmm.
and has discovered a lot of things that other people were slower to get in on, including how much the technology of spacecraft had been developed by the Nazis. He was one of the first to really document a lot of that. But he also is one of the researchers who is interested in what the contactees have to say,
mm-hmm.
and often interviews them. And there are a lot of researchers who won't go there, who just don't touch that because they don't trust it.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there are, I mean, when we're talking about channels and contactees, we do have to realize that everybody has their own filters and agendas and are human, so we need to take it with a grain of salt, that there's a lot of value in a more scientific approach. But people that only look for, you know, the hard physical evidence, they're missing out on so much information, because there's mm-hmm. so many contactees that are getting amazing information, including a lot of technical information. So I think it's, yeah, I admire him for being willing to look at both, although some of the people that he interviews that are contactees, I just have to shake my head. It's like, I don't know, it's a little too out there.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
And is there a question? I mean, you've given us such a wealth of information here, and I really thank you for that. Is there a question you wish I had asked that I didn't? And in other words, is there anything you'd like to add that we did not cover today?
Oh, my. Yeah. Well, you did ask the question earlier about a story that I particularly liked that maybe didn't get in the book.
Mm-hmm.
That is the story of Johnny Marshall, which I think you heard because I've started to talk about it when I give talks. And Johnny Marshall lived in Montana in the summer of 1952 in Dillon, and he was working for a water driller. And he lived in Montana for several months. He was courting a woman in West Yellowstone and then ended up working for her brother's boss. And it was revealed over time that he claimed that he was not from here, mm-hmm. that he was from Alpha Centauri. And that was a little bit hard for people to take in 1952. But particularly his boss, Bess Robel, was totally fascinated and assured him that he would not be ridiculed and that they would, you know, be careful about how they shared that information or whatever. But he did end up leaving quite suddenly when Bess Robel's mother, I believe, I heard this from his son, who said grandmother really liked her wine, and one night just said that she didn't believe anything that Johnny Marshall said, thought it sounded like comic books, and he made it all up.
Hmm.
And he said he was going out for a cigarette and excused himself, and they never saw him again.
Hmm.
But he was here for several months, and according to the sister that he was courting, and according to Bess Robel, she was gone. She had passed by the time that I first heard the story. But according to Bess Robel, who was the boss, she did say that he had taken her up in a spacecraft, her and her two-year-old son at the same time.
Hmm.
And she was quite young. I think she was only 19 or 20. So anyway, there's a lot of information about him, primarily from Bess, but also from some of the family of the gal that he was courting and her brother. So if I ever write another book, it would be about that whole case, because I think they have walked among us for a long time and we can't tell. He looked human. He was mm-hmm. a little bit shorter, but he said he was very tall for the planet that he came from.
Mm.
So that's one. But I also, you know, would like to let people know that there was an amazing story case that was documented in a film, a documentary called The Secret of Red Gate. And it's actually about Deer Lodge and these two children that used to play with grays, a specific kind of ET, along the banks of the Clark Fork River, because they had a place that their home was right on the Clark Fork River.
Mm-hmm.
And the documentary is very interesting, very well done, and you can find it online if you search for The Secrets of Red Gate. It's at one point you could only get the DVD, but I have seen that it's now available online and people can search for it.
Oh, nice.
And watch it. Yeah, and it's, you know, so it's all about what's been going on in Dillon that none of us knew about. Yeah.
Very cool.
So I recommend that. Yeah.
And also, let's see. And by the way, if you write another book, I will definitely be buying that. Want to read more from you. Will you be doing any events where people can hear more? And also, how can people contact you?
Well, at this point, you know, I'm kind of, I'm trying to keep up to some extent with what's happening with the disclosure. There's so much going on.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the Humanities Montana, which funded my talks around the state,
mm-hmm.
lost its funding with the end of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Yes.
And I think that national program was completely
mm-hmm.
done away with. So there's no longer funding for me to travel around. I had a couple of requests before that happened that I had not booked. And I thought, well, I could just call them up and say, how about we just take up donations? Or maybe you have some funds for the library to help me cover some transportation costs and do some talking. But I kind of needed some time off going through a lot of changes and trying to cope with all the changes in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Doing a lot of inner work as well as kind of seeing what's unfolding here and which directions I seem to be called in, because I've always been mission driven, had a strong inner compass about what was mine to do, just based on what was most fascinating to me. And so that's how I ended up in the UFO field. So anyway, so I think I have a website, but I am not monitoring it, and I don't even know for sure that it's still up. At one point it wasn't. It was montanaufos.com. And I don't know if there's any way for that to reach me if somebody were to try to there. But I'm not that hard to find if our people are motivated. I think actually my contact info may still be up on the Humanities Montana website.
Well, we have time for a couple readings from author Kathy Katz in her book, Nature, A Day at a Time. For November 16th, she writes, she's going to write about the tomato. These next two readings are going to be about food. And she opens with a quote from John Postlethwaite and Janet Hobson in The Nature of Life. And they write, on a golden autumn afternoon in 1820, Robert Gibson Johnson, a young colonel in the U.S. Army, stunned the people of Salem, New Jersey. He stood on the steps of the town's courthouse, and with a crowd gathered before him, he committed what seemed at the time a suicidal act. He ate a tomato. And Kathy Katz goes on to write, the tomato, Lycopersicum esculentum, belongs to a family of poisonous plants, including the deadly nightshade and the mandrake. Until recent history, most people considered tomatoes as deadly as arsenic. And then she quotes, and to help speed that enlightened day, to help dispel the tall tales, the fantastic tales that you have been hearing about the thing, to show you that it is not poisonous, that it will not strike you dead, I am going to eat one right now, unquote. Colonel Gibbon Johnson said this as he ate a tomato for the first time in front of a crowd, many of whom were screaming and fainting at his daring spectacle. Colonel Johnson ate the tomato, didn't die, and was eventually elected mayor of the town. Kathy Katz's entry for November 17th is about garlic. She writes, garlic, Allium sativum, is a member of the lily family. Its healing abilities have been recognized since at least 1500 BC to increase energy as a sexual stimulant, to relieve inflammation, and to treat a long list of other ailments, including gangrene, digestive discomfort, and high blood pressure. Garlic contains allicin, considered a more powerful antibiotic than penicillin or tetracycline. The delicate and pale flowers give no clue to the depth and substance of garlic's potential. And then she closes with a quote from Anne McIntyre in Flower Power. And Anne writes, the humble garlic bulb, maligned for its powerful and lingering odor, is a wonderful medicine. As recognized centuries ago, it is an effective antibacterial, antifungal, antiviral, and antiparasitic remedy. Garlic helps to restore wholeness and strength, imparts courage to help overcome fears, and increases resistance to parasitic entities and poisonous influences. Garlic has a stabilizing and harmonious effect. There are a couple events I wanted to tell you about right now. Registration is open for the Santa Run for Education 5K race, and that's going to be Saturday, December 6th. You can go to run.capitalRACE/capital M capital T/capital B O Z E M A N/capital S A N T A capital R U N F O R capital E D U C A T I O N 5K, and you can find your registration there. And then also, Montana Native Plant Society is going to present a virtual presentation on November 18th at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. It's called One Flower, One Place, Spotlight on Missoula's Endemic Wildflower. And I'm going to share a little blurb from them about this event. And they say, nestled in the windswept, arid ridges of Missoula's North Hills grows an endemic wildflower found nowhere else on Earth. Dr. Meredith Zettelmeyer from the University of Montana will share her lab's new research program studying how the endemic Missoula phlox survives, reproduces, and fits into its ecological and evolutionary neighborhood. We will discuss the remarkable floral diversity of this species, its population health, how it's related to similar species, and how it interacts with the local plant and pollinator community. By understanding Missoula phlox's evolution and ecology, we hope to help guide conservation for this rare species and the unique ecosystem it depends on. If you would like a link to register to see this presentation online, you can go to Montana Native Plants website, and that is, I'm going to give you that, mtnativeplants.org/events/. And there's a calendar there under the events listing, and on November 18th on that calendar, there's a little link about this event, and you can click on that and register to see it. Sounds like a educational thing to do, especially if it's kind of cold at night. We'll see what it is by the time you hear this. Well, my thanks today to Steve Grant and Kathy Katz. Thank you to Joan Bird. And our background audio today was Conductivity by Red, Blue, Black, Silver himself. So thanks to him and to Ken Lane for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to the volunteers and supporters of KGVM, and thank you for listening. If you'd like a list of the books Joan Bird talked about in her interview, please leave a voicemail or text for me at 406-404-6246. You can hear this program broadcast on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, watch the skies, keep doing good things, stay well, and sweet dreams. In honor of Native American Heritage Month, with my thanks, Here is the Halusi Nation, and that is two words, Halusi and Nation, from their album A Tribe Called Red, with their song Look at This, and it's a remix. It's about 6 minutes of good music, so get up and move if you like. I'll see you next week.